Hi, Marco Werman here. We're all on deadline at The World. Our spring fundraiser has just 1 week left, so you only have a limited time for your contribution to The World to be matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of that match, we need to raise $17,000 before May 1st. Fact-based journalism with a global perspective is crucial during these uncertain times. You can make our reporting available to millions of people with a tax-deductible gift to The World today. When you give today, your contribution will be doubled by an anonymous donor. That means $75 of support actually becomes $150. The World is freely available to anyone, on air, on demand, and on the web. It's always been our goal to report stories from around the world with nuance, context, and with voices of the people affected. Today, we ask your support of that goal. Help keep access to The World free for everyone. Please go to theworld.org/give and contribute today, while your gift will have twice the impact. We still need to raise $17,000 to take full advantage of an anonymous donor's match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link right here in the episode notes. Stay safe, stay healthy, and thank you. When we do get through this phase of lockdown, traveling abroad will be different. Expect temperature checks at the airport and maybe a less than warm welcome overseas.
Why the heck would I want an American here if they haven't been tested?
I'm Marco Werman. Also, the holy month of Ramadan begins this week. The pandemic means lots of Muslims will be missing out on large gatherings to break the daily fast. It's also an opportunity
to actually self-reflect, try to improve your morals, try to increase or enhance your worship as an individual.
And what to do with our time in quarantine? Learn a new language, a musical instrument, or maybe you're like me, hunched over hundreds of colorful little pieces of cardboard.
There is nothing more satisfying than putting the final piece in a puzzle.
Those stories and more today here on The World. How the heck do we get out of this? No question seems more relevant right now. In a moment, we'll hear from Singapore, where testing and contact tracing contain the virus for a while. But first to Europe, where a number of countries are taking tentative steps to reopen. On Monday, parks and forests in Poland went back to normal. In the Czech Republic, people could go to open-air markets. And in Norway, preschoolers went back to class with some restrictions, as his dad explained to the French news agency.
Normally we follow the kid inside in the kindergarten. Now the parents are not allowed to go inside. So we agreed a specific time that I should deliver my son to one of the staff, which was 8 o'clock.
Germany is taking things one step further. Smaller retail stores are now allowed to reopen. Chancellor Angela Merkel made the announcement earlier this week with this warning.
Natürlich fällt das schwer. Aber wenn wir jetzt Beschränkungen aufheben, wenn wir Lockerungen machen,
of course this is difficult. But if we now ease restrictions, then we just don't know exactly what the repercussions will be. And that's why we have to proceed incrementally, slowly and carefully. It would be tragic if we knowingly relapsed and if we knowingly endangered these first successes.
And there's the key issue, relapse. No one at this point can be sure what will happen next. Germany has an extensive testing system in place, along with contact tracing. In addition, pilot antibody tests are already taking place in different parts of Germany. The goal there is to find out how many people have actually had the disease already, with a plan to test the entire population in the next few months. Chancellor Merkel said that some progress has been made.
Wir dürfen keine Sekunde aus den Augen verlieren.
But not for a second should we lose sight of the fact that we are still only at the very beginning of the pandemic, and we are still a long way off from beating it. And I think that particularly at the beginning of this week, where the first restrictions are being lifted, we need to make this clear again and again.
That's a lesson Singapore is learning this week. The small country in Southeast Asia has been held up as a role model because the government there acted swiftly to fight the coronavirus by closing borders and using technology to aggressively track infections. But then COVID-19 infections in Singapore suddenly spiked to more than 10,000. There may be a sobering lesson here for the United States, as the World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
The new coronavirus has generated lots of new lingo. There's social distancing, flatten the curve, the dreaded super spreader. And in Singapore, they have the circuit breaker.
Let's be quite clear about what this circuit breaker means. It really requires all of us to minimize movement and stay at home as much as possible.
That's a top government minister in Singapore, Lawrence Wong. The circuit breaker is basically a campaign to get people to stay at home. You can go for a walk, you cannot go to a party. You can go grab a cup of coffee, you cannot stand close to someone in line, or you might get a huge fine. It's not as hardcore as, say, China's total lockdown in Wuhan, or even Italy. It's actually closer to New York. And it seemed to be working great, until...
Singapore has reported a record 1,426 new COVID-19 cases, the first time daily figures have exceeded 1,000.
Yep, big spike. Singapore, a city-state of 5 million people, suddenly has the most cases in Southeast Asia. And this is a bad sign for everyone, including the United States. Singapore's recipe for success is circuit breaker plus testing people like crazy and aggressive contact tracing, where authorities do detective work and find out everyone that an infected person has hung out with, and they check them too. That cocktail of strategies is now being pushed in the U.S. Dr. Anthony Fauci says contact tracing is key for America to get to its big re-entry, people going back to school and work.
The real proof of the pudding of the success of this re-entry is how quickly and effectively you identify them, you get them out of circulation, you give them care where needed, and you do contact tracing.
But if Singapore is now seeing a second outbreak, does that mean their golden strategy, the one America wants to imitate, isn't as effective as we'd hoped? That's the fear, at least. So it's worth asking, what exactly went wrong in Singapore?
We've seen outbreaks in several foreign worker dormitories. Many dorms have cases, and some dorms have many cases.
Dorms for migrant workers, says Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, recently addressing the nation. These are cement rooms with a dozen people just crammed in there on bunk beds. Migrant workers from China, Malaysia, Bangladesh, and infections were probably growing there weeks ago, even before the circuit breaker policy kicked in. The prime minister says Singapore would now be in really, really bad shape with no circuit breaker at all.
If some of us fail to comply strictly with the measures, the circuit breaker will fail, then all our inconvenience, pain and sacrifice will have been in vain.
What is the lesson here? Well, for U.S. cities like, say, New York, there will be a lull in cases at some point, and lots of people will think, we beat it, it's over. But even in Singapore, an inspiration to health experts around the world, they still missed these hidden hotspots of infection. If you lift the lockdown too soon, they explode, and the quarantine starts all over again. So for now, as Prime Minister Lee says, please just stay home.
If you really have no choice but to go out for food or necessities, make sure you wear a mask and stay a safe distance away from everyone else. And don't linger. Don't dawdle.
For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
When we do eventually start to emerge from our current era of self-isolation, we're going to be stepping into a very different world. And that's going to take some getting used to. We keep hearing that, but what will that world look like? Our next guest believes things like temperature checks and nose swabs at airports or face shields for fans at sporting events, those will be common. Maybe at restaurants, wait staff in latex gloves and single-use paper menus. This is the brave new world that former Homeland Security official Julia Kayyem is starting to see.
We will be living with the virus for the years to come. We'll be managing around it. We'll try to box it in. We'll try to hide from it. But unlike most recoveries from disasters where, you know, the hurricane comes and goes, the tornado comes and goes, we're going to have to recover while adapting to the existence of the virus. For one, you know, public transportation. Think about lots of people in tubes underground. You're going to have to ensure masks and temperature systems. Employers are going to have guarantees for their workers or employees if they need their employees to come back.
So let's look at international travel. What might airports look like?
So airports will have to be testing spots. In other words, they're going to test for temperatures. And we already see this happening globally. There will be passports for people that have already gotten the disease or that are showing immunity to the disease. So you're going to have a preferred class and a potentially exposed class. We'll probably have separate facilities, if not airplanes themselves, for vulnerable populations or populations that may be at own risk. We will sit differently, no middle seats likely, and probably a requirement of masks.
So this is not guesswork or sci-fi speculation, Juliet. You've been canvassing experts in a wide range of fields, and this is what they're telling you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Our experience of going out in public will be different because for the most part, we will have to wear masks for any area that's not, say, a park or going for a run. And if we want to go to a restaurant, you know, the restaurant will have half as many tables. The waiter will likely be in a mask, wearing gloves, disposable menus. This is the way it is going to have to be until, right? And now I want to do the good news, which is we will learn as we go along how to do this better and less like a hammer where all of us are inside.
Are you envisioning quarantines after all international travel?
People that I've talked to who are planning out global travel say, look, there are going to be countries that view the United States as a risk, right? So the irony is, as we're closing our borders here, we are actually a country that other countries, say Singapore, South Korea, New Zealand, will view as, why the heck would I want an American here if they haven't been tested? So there will be quarantining, and which we're already seeing for people arriving, which means we will be doing a lot less traveling. I mean, you're not going to go to South Korea for a business meeting if you have to be inside for 2 weeks after. On a personal level, I am on the road once or twice a week in my old life. I've taken all travel off for this year, not simply because it won't be allowed, but something we're not talking about is, you know, governors can decide things, presidents or prime ministers can decide things, but we're each going to have our own risk calculation about whether it's worth it. And I have three kids and I'm responsible to them. I want to live a long time. If I don't do a flight to DC this year, that's okay.
Mm. I'm thinking about Denmark, for example, where they're sending young children back to school in small classrooms with hourly hand washing. Are you seeing some innovative approaches to our new daily life that just are impressing you in one way or another?
Absolutely. So I advise a lot of companies. I think one of the things that this has done is it has gotten reluctant employers to the idea of telework much more comfortable with it. Now, of course, our productivity is probably high now because we want to prove that we can telework. But the whole idea of bringing your whole workforce in is something that large companies and small companies are reconsidering now. How they're thinking about it is, of course, in waves. You'd have team A, team B, team C coming on different days. You are seeing sporting planners think about ways in which spectators would wear full plastic masks, which I know sounds scary, but look, we get used to all of this stuff just to let people enjoy sports.
Have you seen any innovations in other countries?
So some countries that are ahead of us in terms of testing are testing at almost all public spaces, whether you're going into a market or workplace. Employers are demanding it to assess whether someone has temperature. And then, of course, schools. I think the big question mark still out there is, of course, residential colleges and universities. No decisions have been made globally for dorms, and I think a lot of parents are waiting to hear about that.
Former Homeland Security official Juliet Kayyem, she teaches at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Always good to speak, Julia. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just before we take a break, here's a story that caught our attention today from a rural corner of Tasmania, the island off the coast of Australia. It's about the return of a prodigal sheep. Her name is Prickles. 7 years ago, she made a break for freedom, bolting from the farm where she lived during a bushfire. This week, Prickles came back. As farmer Alice Gray told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, Prickles looked a little different.
Oh, she is absolutely round, like a great big fluffy ball of wool. She's quite a sight to behold.
Prickles had been on the lam for all those years and had not been sheared. She looked like a big punk rock cotton ball, and Prickles has had to readjust to life in lockdown.
She was quite perturbed by some turkeys when we first brought her back to our farmyard, but she seems to have now made friends with sheep and turkeys and ducks and everyone else who seems to wander through our paddock.
Now that Prickles is back home, that massive woolly coat is coming off. But Alice Gray decided to make it a competition to guess the weight of Prickles' fleece. The family is raising money for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Gray said her family and Prickles are lucky to be able to self-isolate on a farm in Tasmania, but they wanted to do more for those who can't.
To help people who aren't as fortunate as Prickles, being able to have a safe place to be at this time.
Prickles will be sheared on May 1st. We've got pictures of her in all her woolly glory. Go to theworld.org. You're listening to The World. Hi, this is Marco Werman. We know you value what we do here at The World. I'm asking you to demonstrate that through your financial support. Our spring campaign only has 1 week to go. That's 1 week to get your contribution matched by an anonymous donor. In order to take full advantage of the match, we need to raise $17,000 by May 1st. During these unprecedented times, our fact-based global coverage is a critical guidepost for listeners and readers. Our coverage is, and has always been, freely available to anyone who wants it. That happens because of listener support. These days, more than ever, independent journalism is an important part of our democracy. We're asking for your support today. Every contribution made in support of The World will be matched, but we have to raise $17,000 to take full advantage of this generous match. Go to theworld.org/give or follow the link in the podcast notes. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. One way the Trump administration has responded to the coronavirus pandemic is by pushing forward a range of tougher immigration policies. Along the U.S.-Mexico border, for example, all asylum seekers are being turned back. As Emily Green reports, this also means that for the first time, the U.S. is turning away any children crossing that border by themselves.
In Matamoros, Mexico, just across from the Texas border, hundreds of small tents are crowded together on the banks of the Rio Grande River. Around 1,500 asylum seekers, mostly from Central America, live here. They've been waiting for many months because the U.S. government says they must wait until their cases are decided. Daniel has been here for more than 10 months. He and the other asylum seekers in this story asked to use only their first names because their immigration cases are pending. Daniel's with his girlfriend and 9-year-old son. They fled Honduras. My vision is to give my son a better life, he says, one in the U.S. Conditions at the camp are precarious. People here share a few dozen toilets, and illness spreads easily. So, in late March, Daniel and his girlfriend took a drastic step. They'd send their son to the U.S. by himself. For decades, the U.S. has allowed children who show up at the border alone to enter the country. Daniel figured, even though the U.S. is now the epicenter of the coronavirus crisis, it was still safer than the tent camp in Mexico. His son walked across a bridge that separates Mexico and the U.S. But when Daniel's son reached the U.S., immigration agents told him to go back to Mexico. They weren't accepting kids now. That's because on March 21st, the Trump administration began summarily blocking all asylum seekers from entering the U.S. at the border, including children. Since then, around 400 kids traveling alone have been turned away. U.S. officials declined an interview, but Mark Morgan, the acting head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, has said it's a public health issue, the coronavirus.
The disease doesn't know age. In fact, what we've heard from the medical providers is that the younger children can actually be carriers.
This is Morgan in a press call in March.
When they come across the border, they pose an absolute concrete public health risk to this country and everybody that they come in contact with. So this is not about immigration. This is about public health.
Critics say that Morgan's reasoning is deceptive.
That's just a flat-out distortion and perversion of the public health laws, and it also misrepresents what's actually going on here.
Lucas Gutentag is an immigration attorney and law professor at Stanford University.
There's lots and lots of cross-border traffic that's continuing. All commercial traffic continues. Trucking is continuing. So what's happening is children and refugees who are entitled to legal protection have been singled out by this order to further the Trump administration's immigration agenda.
Mexican authorities are also playing a role, physically preventing children from reaching the U.S. border. Like 7-year-old Haiti, her dad sent her, alone, to ask for protection at the U.S. border. Her dad made this decision after a doctor told him the tent camp in Mexico wasn't safe. Here's Heidi's dad, Pablo.
Ay, nos dijo que si es que llega esa enfermedad acá que aquí, nos vamos a morir.
The doctor told us, if the virus hits a camp, we'll all die. Pablo sent his daughter with three other girls whose parents had made the same decision. The four girls, ages 3, 5, 7, and 8, walked across a bridge toward the U.S.
Y la migración mexicana corría.
Mexican officials ran to grab the girls, Pablo says. They held them in a shelter on the Mexican side. Pablo got his daughter back 2 days later. He describes his daughter as quiet and patient. But at night, when they are in the tent together, she cries. She asks, when are we going to get to the United States? Why can't we leave here? He says. Pablo tells her they must wait. Their next court hearing is in May, but because of the coronavirus, it's likely to be delayed. Chances are they'll be living here for many more months to come. For The World, Emily Green.
A famine of biblical proportions. That's the UN's warning that urgent action is needed to avoid a catastrophe. The leader of the World Food Program says the coronavirus pandemic could bring hunger to more than 250 million people. Of special concern, 10 countries that already face conflict and crisis, Yemen, Venezuela, and Afghanistan among them. Meanwhile, food systems have already been disrupted by the coronavirus. The frustrating irony is that massive amounts of food are going to waste. André Laperriere in Montreal is the executive director of GODAN, the Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition.
There are three basic steps: the production, the processing, and the distribution. And there's food waste at all three levels, exacerbated by the coronavirus. First, in terms of production, there's a lot of losses there because of the lack of unskilled workers. The window that producers have to harvest crops and bring it to the markets is very short. So if you don't have the workers available at that very moment, then your crop is lost. Problem number two, processing. We see that especially in the meat industry, because in meat processing plants, you're working on a chain, so you're very close to other people. So therefore, the risk of infection is very high. We've seen plants shutting down, some trying to clean up and reopen. But we estimate that around 10% of the meat production is currently being affected by the coronavirus.
How much waste do you see at the level of distribution, like getting food to market?
That's where we see a lot of losses right now. Half of all the food that's being produced goes to institutions, be it restaurants, community services, and the like. And the other half goes in the grocery stores where you do your shopping every day. The problem now is that because most restaurants, community services, and others have shut down, the producers that used to sell in bulk or in large quantities to these institutions, now you have no market for it or very limited. So a lot of milk used to go to schools, for example, as part of school meals. Now that the schools are closed, there's no real market. So what to do with the milk? You can only store so much for so long. So as a result of that, excess production has to be thrown away. And that is true with a lot of other perishable foods.
Could food waste now, do you think, lead to food shortages further down the line?
Yes, but not overall in terms of overall famine or food shortage of that kind. We're likely to see more and more short-term shortages, like you may go to your usual market and today there's no more T-bones available, or there's no pork today, or there's something else missing on that day. It may not be missing somewhere else, but where you are, it may. So people should think of is to buy local. What you can buy locally makes a big difference because it helps support your local producers. Number two is for governments to resist the temptation to go for protectionism, to continue to let food flow and seasonal workers flow the same way. I'm just thinking examples like Kazakhstan now has decided that they're going to stop exporting wheat because they feel that they need to keep more of their own production. But as a result of that, neighboring countries are suffering quite a bit, which in turn leads to social disturbances and other problems. So keeping the food flows open and related manpower is really key to minimize food waste, inflation, and hopefully help resume or restart the system.
André Laperriere is the executive director of GODAN, the Global Open Data for Agriculture and Nutrition. He's been speaking with us from Montreal. André, thank you very much for your time.
It was my pleasure, Marco.
News headlines are next. You're listening to The World. As the coronavirus spreads, so does false information. Scientists aren't too surprised. They've seen the same thing with climate change.
You need experts to deal with complicated problems. And you can't just have somebody tweeting at a virus to make it disappear. That's just not going to work.
Expertise and reliable information, it turns out, work better. That's ahead here on The World. Ramadan begins tomorrow night. It's the month-long observance by Muslims around the globe, marked with fasting and prayers. In a normal year, it's a time for gathering together to break the daily fast. This year, though, Islamic communities are adapting to the reality of marking the holy month during a pandemic. Noor Hadi is an imam at the Baitul Futu Mosque in South London.
For us Muslims in the UK, as you of course know, we're going through a lockdown across the country. So, of course, Muslims won't be able to congregate at the mosques when Ramadan begins. So I think what's different this year is the fact that what we would usually do in a mosque, we're bringing them all online. Mm. We're going to be going live, delivering them lectures. What's different this year as well, because Ramadan normally brings such a togetherness feeling, people usually break their fast together and they usually open their fast together as well. So before sunrise and after sunset. So they're going to miss that feeling of breaking and eating together, right?
Mm. And just practically for people to break the fast together, are you going to be encouraging families to like put a laptop in the kitchen?
Yeah, exactly. So we've set up a virtual breaking of a fast together. And before actually breaking the fast, we normally have a custom in the mosque where there's short talks and there's inspiring lectures and prayers together. Those short talks will be online. You know, then we'll virtually eating together and breaking a fast together.
So it feels like you've got online workarounds to help people who would normally be isolated. What do you do for people, for families who don't have computers or Wi-Fi?
Without having computer or Wi-Fi, we've actually set up a helpline with a national charity in the UK known as Humanity First. With that helpline, even if you don't have internet, just contact us through your local telephone. And we have youth members actively waiting for those calls from 8 a.m. in the morning to 8 p.m. in the evening. And we try to dispatch someone on that very day to go to those families and actually help them running errands like getting groceries, prescriptions, medication. Just through the helpline service, we've helped around 5,004 UK households.
Noor Hadi, it occurs to me that congregating as Muslims in the UK isn't just an expression of faith, whether it's Ramadan or Friday prayer. It's also an expression of solidarity in the face of continuing microaggressions and outright animosity. What does the Muslim community lose by not having the month-long moment of community and solidarity of Ramadan?
There's this whole, I think, idea that, fine, Ramadan does bring a lot of togetherness and this sense of congregation and community aspect to it. But it's easily forgotten that Ramadan, there's another aspect to Ramadan, and that's the whole purpose of being able to self-reflect and improve yourself. As Muslims, we try to stay optimistic and positive when it comes to this. And this month is giving us a time, just like the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, spent in isolation during Ramadan. And it's giving us like a month of days just to actually self-reflect, try to improve your morals, try to increase or enhance your worship as an individual.
This year is peculiar in so many ways. What does Ramadan mean to you this year?
For me, I see that this Ramadan, not only do I get a lot of time to actually self-reflect and try to improve myself as a human being, but because as a Muslim, a huge part of your faith is that you also help one another. We believe that one of the rights that Islam or your religion has upon you is that you take care of humanity and you try to serve God's creation. So now that we see that our neighbors are in need, it gives us extra zeal this Ramadan, because we know that doing this and helping others is actually increasing our spirituality and helping us get closer to God as well.
Noor Hadi is an imam at the Baitul Futu Mosque in South London. Very good to speak with you. Thank you very much for being with us, and Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you, thank you. Hope you guys have a lovely month ahead and stay safe and take care.
Early last year, two men from Syria were arrested in Germany, one in Berlin, the other near Frankfurt. They are both believed to be former officials with Syria's state security apparatus. Tomorrow, their trial begins. The charges? Crimes against humanity. Syrians are watching closely to see if the trial brings some measure of justice after so many years of war. Holly Young reports from Berlin.
The trial is taking place in the German city of Koblenz, on the banks of the Rhine River in the western part of the country. Many legal cases here have been delayed because of the coronavirus, but the regional court decided that this one was too urgent to put on hold. It's the first criminal trial worldwide on state torture in Syria. The two Syrian defendants are known for legal reasons as Anwar R and Ayad A. They're facing charges of crimes against humanity. Anwar R's alleged crimes include murder, rape, and torture. Both men are said to have travelled to Germany as refugees. Wolfgang Kallek is with the legal non-profit ECCHR in Berlin. He says putting two Syrian officials on trial is an important milestone.
Western European countries did only arrest and prosecute those who were fighting in the various militias, such as ISIS and others. But to cover the magnitude of what happened in Syria during the last 10 years, one need to investigate the torture regime of President Assad.
Alongside a network of European partners, Kallek's group have spent years gathering evidence, hearing testimonies about alleged atrocities committed by Syrian government officials. The joint plaintiffs in the Koblenz trial are Syrian survivors of torture. Kallek says he hopes that this trial is just a beginning.
Syrians should see that the impunity will not be forever, and President Assad and his people won't be impune and untouchable forever.
The trial in Germany is based on the principle of universal jurisdiction. It allows states to prosecute certain crimes committed anywhere in the world. In the past, efforts to put Syrians on trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague have failed. That's because Syria is not a signatory to the ICC, and Russia and China have blocked attempts to refer Syrian crimes to the court. Germany is home to a large Syrian refugee community. Mariana Karkutli is a law student and activist in Berlin. She says Syrians like her will be watching the Koblenz trial very closely.
There is a sense of kind of justice that people can feel that can be delivered to them. So in this sense, I'm really, really excited. And I feel like we are witnessing a historical moment in this sense.
Karkutli is one of many Syrians who have helped to gather evidence of torture in state detention centres.
There is an acknowledgement that this happened and this is still happening. And this is something that they can build up on politically. So in this sense, I feel like it's a moment of hope for lots of Syrians, like who also I interviewed. It was a moment of, yes, but this is not the justice we're looking for. We want to establish justice in Syria. But this could be the beginning of the road. So beginning of a long road towards justice.
That is something Anwar Al-Buni says he's been working on for 30 years. He's a Syrian human rights lawyer, today working in Berlin on behalf of torture victims. Al-Buni says to him, it's not only these two men going on trial in Germany, it's the whole Syrian regime. And as for Syrians back home...
Do you think they're paying attention to this trial?
I think all the Syrians now look for what happened against like these criminals. Many attention, many question we had.
Al-Buni says the trial in Koblenz is important for the future of Syria, but he says it's also just a first step towards accountability. For the world, I'm Holly Young in Berlin.
President Trump says limiting immigration protects American jobs and health. That argument is not new. Whenever there's a crisis here in the U.S., questions come up about immigration. Erica Lee is the author of America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. I've asked her how we've seen this play out before.
The 1918 flu pandemic is actually really fascinating to compare to what's happening today. So first, we have to understand that, of course, during World War I, immigration was effectively halted due to the war and the end of passenger steamship travel. But even during the flu pandemic, in which the U.S. lost 650,000 lives, the country didn't try to limit immigration. In fact, we still let in over 110,000 immigrants. And the Bureau of Immigration touted its kind treatment of sick immigrants.
I mean, Erica, the stories right now of hate directed at Asians, Asian Americans, we're hearing stories of acid attacks. So personally, what has this been like for you as someone whose grandfather arrived in this country during the Chinese Exclusion Act?
Yeah, you know, I remember hearing stories of my parents insisting that during World War II into the 1950s and 60s, they still felt the sting not only of Chinese exclusion, but also just anti-Asian racism in general, obviously Japanese American incarceration as well. And their philosophy was, we need to show that we're, quote, Americans first and Chinese second. So for them, there was this sense of sort of ultra assimilation. We need to prove that we're loyal. We need to prove that we're patriots. We need to prove that we're assimilated. I think that this sense of worthiness, you know, is really being questioned for Chinese Americans and other Asian Americans, feeling like they're being suspected of bringing the virus and spreading the virus. And it's, you know, it takes its toll. It's not just these horrific, violent attacks, these physical attacks, or the name calling, or the social shunning. It's also just this internalized sense of, I thought we belonged, but look how easily the tables can be turned on us. And I think there's a palpable sense of fear now that we're all supposed to wear masks out in public. There is a racialized image of an Asian person in a mask that is quite different than any other type of person wearing a medical mask.
I had not even thought about that mask aspect to all of it.
Yeah, I think it's, I certainly feel very self-conscious now wearing a mask outside.
You've also written, Erica, that Americans have the power to combat xenophobia. Obviously, as individuals, we all have that power. Aside from a person's vote, though, what would that take today? What would you like to see?
That's a really tough one. I think that so many of us feel disempowered because there is the legal challenges. Those have to continue. But many of us aren't skilled and tooled in doing that. We can support those organizations. We need to make sure that we're supporting immigrant-serving organizations and, of course, vote. But as we're seeing xenophobia sort of spread out into the streets and into our neighborhoods and on our subways, one of the things that we can all do is stop it. We need to be those bystanders who don't just look away, but actually take action to intervene and to protect those who are vulnerable.
Erica Lee is the author of America for Americans, A History of Xenophobia in the United States. Erica, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I am not kidding when I say this. When I'm done with this interview, I will spend a few minutes unwinding in the dining room looking for a little piece. A little piece with a blip of blue in the corner and a green and yellow pattern with fish on it. Yeah, I'm working on a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, third one my family is taking on during the lockdown. I hear others are busy on their own jigsaw puzzles, a lot of people. Julie Wilkins is director of JHG Puzzles in Dorset, England. What's business been like for you, Julie, since the coronavirus outbreak and subsequent lockdowns took effect?
Well, probably our sales have quadrupled, maybe even higher than that.
When did your company first notice the uptick in demand?
We thought originally that it was Mother's Day that was causing the incredible surge in sales.
So that's Mother's Day in the UK, right?
Mother's Day UK, yes. And we normally get quite a blip then and sales go up because lots of mums do puzzles. But it just never came back down again.
How big is your company, JHG Puzzles, and how many puzzles are you able to make in a day?
We're shipping out at the moment and making probably between 200 and 250 a day. There are only four of us. We actually glue and make the boxes by hand, and then we have a couple of large hydraulic cutting presses, which we use to cut. They're manually put in a box, hopefully the right puzzle in the right box, but we don't always get it right.
So I've been going to eBay to find jigsaw puzzles, and it seems a whole new community of jigsaw puzzlers has arisen, and people are buying and selling almost as quickly. Who's buying puzzles these days?
We're seeing an upsurge in sales in children's puzzles because there are a lot of children at home and slightly older children too, who now got a bit more time to spend with mum and dad, or mum and dad have got a bit more time to spend with them. And right. It's good family time.
Julie, if I may be overly analytical, the world is broken and jigsaw puzzles give us a sense that we can repair things and make them whole again. Do you buy that as an explanation?
I sort of do. There is nothing more satisfying than putting the final piece in a puzzle. You know, we all do lots of other things, but putting that last bit in is really gives you a sense of achievement. And I think that's important. People feel that they can fix it, they can do it, they can make it. And you get an achievement when you see the finished picture and it matches the picture on the box.
Julie Wilkins, director of JHD Puzzles in Dorset, England. Thank you for your time. Thank you for such perfect explanations.
You're welcome.
As COVID-19 spreads, so does false information about the disease.
No need for people to be in a panic, releasing fake news on social media.
To combat widespread misinformation.
Medical University of Vienna called it fake news.
People need clear, accurate information.
In some ways, this is expected. The false information about the disease has some similarities to the spread of misinformation about climate change. Stefan Lewandowski is a cognitive scientist at the University of Bristol in the UK and an expert in misinformation.
The number one misinformation is that COVID-19 is not much worse than the flu, when in fact that's unfortunately not true. COVID-19 is a far worse virus with a much higher fatality rate. At the other end, we have conspiracy theories, and there is a whole bunch of those, mainly about the origin of COVID-19.
What's interesting is you've spent part of your career looking at misinformation about climate change. I'm curious to know what similarities between misinformation about COVID-19 and climate change you're seeing.
One of the similarities is that in both cases, the views are politically polarized, at least in the United States. We know from a lot of survey data that in the United States, climate change is denied mainly by people on the political right. We just did a survey last week in the U.S. involving 2,000 respondents, and we found precisely the same thing. People on the political right are more dismissive of the risk from COVID than people on the political left.
We know with climate change that fossil fuel companies have sown the seeds of skepticism over the years. Is there any evidence suggesting who's doing this with misinformation around the coronavirus and who might stand to gain if that is in fact happening?
With the coronavirus, it appears as though most of the misinformation comes from not leading political figures, but from the population at large. Only about 20% of the misinformation regarding COVID is issued by opinion leaders and celebrities and so on. However, the 20% of opinion leaders who are providing the misinformation, they receive a lot more engagement on social media. So their influence, despite being in the minority, is nonetheless considerable.
With someone who is misinformed, you're wrong is usually not the best way to open this conversation. What is the best way to talk to someone who is misinformed about COVID or climate for that matter?
I think, first of all, you have to understand that there are different people and different audiences. You must tailor your message to the audience. It turns out that most people are sensitive to the scientific consensus. If you tell people that 97 out of 100 climate scientists agree on the fundamentals of the science, that is sufficient to boost their attitudes towards climate change a little bit. With a bit of luck, maybe this crisis is a global reset and people are beginning to recognize again that you need experts to deal with complicated problems. And you can't just have somebody tweeting at a virus to make it disappear. That's just not going to work.
Stefan Lewandowski is a cognitive scientist at the University of Bristol in the UK. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye.
Today is Earth Day, its 50th anniversary, and the start of the modern environmental movement. This year, people are celebrating virtually. How exactly? We asked environmentalists around the world to share part of their day with us.
Hello, my name is Andrea León and I'm from Mexico.
Hi, my name is Samantha Supaya. I'm currently on lockdown in Manila, Philippines.
Hello, I am Ala Mustafa and I live in Sana'a City, the capital of Yemen.
My name is Priska Daka from Zimbabwe. For me, Earth Day is a day to just take a pause and really appreciate our beautiful planet and to think about what I need to do as an individual to protect it and to also inspire others.
Hello, everyone. This is Hira Wajahat from Pakistan.
Today, we are organizing an interactive panel discussion that will be held online on the theme titled Flattening the Climate Curve, the lessons we have learned from the response to the COVID-19 pandemic and how we can apply those good practices in Pakistan for positive climate action.
Happy Earth Day. I'm Sainath Manigandan, studying in grade 8 in GEMS United Indian School, Abu Dhabi. My virtual event for this day is Artist for the Earth. I believe that art is a beautiful form of expression to create a long-lasting and powerful impact on others.
My name is Elias Gaveda, also known as Zinja. I'm from Malawi, the warm heart of Africa, and I'm a co-founder of Conservation Music Malawi. Conservation Music Malawi uses the catalytic power of music and art to promote environmental sustainability. The message in these songs, poems, and the short story are generally focused on advocating for climate action to mitigate the negative impacts of climate change.
Buenas tardes, mi nombre es Francisco Javier Vera Manzanares. Vivo en Villeta, Cundinamarca, una ciudad de Colombia. No hay planeta B y este es el único que alberga vida en el universo. Cuidemos nuestro planeta.
Hi everyone and happy Earth Day 2020. My name is Elham. I am a climate justice activist from Afghanistan. And as the initiator of the climate strike movement in Afghanistan, I've worked together with a young and strongly committed team of the climate activists and environmentalists from around the country. And we have organized an online celebration.
Hi there, my name's Frances Hume, based in Glasgow. And we actually have something that's called a World Interfaith Harmony Grove. And we've encouraged people to pay for trees in that grove.
My name is Zorica Kozlovacki and I live in Zrenjanin, Serbia. I'm conductor of Youth Mix Choir of the Music School Josif Marinković. To support Earth Day, we created a virtual choir of 40 singers. We have chosen the song Evening Rise. The lyrics are: Evening rise, spirit come. Sun goes down when the day is done. Mother Earth awakens me with the heartbeat of the sea.
Awakens me with the heartbeat of the sea.
A lot going on even indoors. Those were voices of people around the globe celebrating Earth Day in isolation today. They share their stories with the world's Anna Kussmer. And that's where we leave you on this Earth Day. The world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.